This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 14th of April, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, at BP's annual meeting, demonstrators outside and shareholders inside express growing anger at the oil giant's response to environmental concerns. We go to the Thai-Burma border, where officials threaten to shut down refugee camps home to tens of thousands of people.
Two people, side by side, they kick me. And at the same time, they pour water on my face.
And environmentalists criticize a 2011 budget rider that delists grey wolves as an endangered species.
What it means for the Endangered Species Act is now that anytime anybody has an issue or a problem with an endangered species, they will run to Congress and try to get the same sort of deal.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Shelling continued today in Misrata, Libya, and media sources report the rebel death toll has reached 23. Conditions are worsening for residents trying to flee the war zone as well.
The condition of about 6,000 migrants in and around the port in Misrata is very intolerable in the sense that most of them suffer from dehydration, lack of food, lack of shelter, and their condition is really very bad.
International Organization for Migration head Jumbe Omari Jumbe says they have been trying to evacuate civilians, but their efforts have been stymied by the recent intensification of fighting. Jumbe said a humanitarian aid ship is currently on its way to Misrata to deliver supplies to the coastal town. Yesterday, rebel leaders called on the U.S. to step up its involvement in the NATO-led military action. Today, at a meeting in Berlin, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton reaffirmed the U.S.'s current role, but made no promises for further action.
We are also sharing the same goal, which is to see the end of the Gaddafi regime in Libya, and we are contributing in many ways in order to see that goal realized.
The international community seems to be united behind calls for a ceasefire in Libya, but there's less accord over what should happen to leader Muammar Gaddafi and whether to arm rebel forces. In response to large protests by women and children yesterday in Syria, the government says it will pull its secret police out of the eastern port of Banias and replace them with military forces. Euronews reports the government also agreed to release many of the men taken into custody on Tuesday, the action that prompted the mass protests yesterday. Many of the men released claim they were tortured while in custody. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has formed a new government, according to state media. Assad appointed a new prime minister and cabinet. Emergency crews in Japan have found the bodies of 10 tsunami victims as they begin to search the off-limits area around the damaged Fukushima nuclear power plant. The City Morning Herald reports rescued workers intended to make their way closer to the plant in an effort to recover the bodies of an estimated 1,000 victims. The 300 rescue workers are wearing protective suits and masks. The death toll from the earthquake and tsunami currently stands at more than 13,000, with another approximately 15,000 still missing. This week, pro-democracy protests have erupted in the tiny southern African nation of Swaziland. The monarchy in power has met protesters with force, using water cannons and tear gas to disperse demonstrations. In a statement issued today, union organizers called off planned demonstrations, fearing the lives of protesters were at risk. The unions called the decision not a defeat, but a, quote, tactical retreat to re-strategize on the next phase of this mass rolling action. The Oklahoma legislature has passed new restrictions on abortions performed in the state. Under the new legislation, which is expected to be signed by the Republican governor, abortion would not be allowed after the 20th week. Another law passed prohibits private health care companies from offering abortion services in their basic plans. Women wanting that coverage must pay additional. Yesterday, Kansas's governor signed bills forbidding abortions after the 21st week and requiring girls under the age of 18 to get consent from both parents before having the procedure. The bills also require enhanced state reporting by abortion clinics. In Illinois, legislation targeting abortion clinics with stricter health standards failed to gain enough support in the House. There are 2.6 million stillborn babies delivered worldwide every year. According to a new study in the Lancet Medical Journal, the World Health Organization is calling on governments to acknowledge stillbirths as a public health problem. Dr. Fredrik Froen is from the Norwegian Institute of Public Health.
The vast majority of stillbirths, 80%, are never given a name. They are never held or dressed by the mother. They don't have a funeral. They are disposed of in the simplest possible way. That invisibility at the personal level is also seen for the mothers. They are, a large proportion of them are marginalized.
Nearly two-thirds of the stillbirths occur in 10 countries, and still, the study says, many stillbirths are not even reported. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood, in San Francisco. In London, oil giant British Petroleum held its annual general meeting, the first since the Gulf oil spill disaster nearly a year ago. Angry protesters gathered outside the venue, including environmentalists, trade union reps, and fishermen. In this video uploaded to YouTube, Clayton Thomas Muller of the Matthias Colomb Cree First Nation in Manitoba, Canada, sings an indigenous song outside the meeting venue in protest of BP's tar sands extraction in Canada. Some Gulf Coast residents travelled to London for the meeting, including a BP shareholder who read a letter from the father of one of the workers killed on the Deepwater Horizon rig. Texas shrimper and activist Diane Wilson was arrested after entering the building and pouring an oil-like substance on herself. Security officers thwarted attempts by several other Gulf Coast residents to enter the meeting. But residents of the Gulf Coast aren't the only ones unhappy with BP. Some shareholders are critical of BP's response to safety and environmental issues. Mark Regier is one such BP investor. He's director of stewardship investing at MMA Praxis Mutual Funds. He represents a coalition of shareholders that own about 35 million BP shares and are unhappy with the oil giant on ethical and environmental grounds. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us anything more about the scenes outside the venue?
We hear outside that there are groups trying to get in. I believe there have been protests, though I've heard of nothing about violence. We do know that several protesters were removed from the inside of the meeting, and that some folks, even who hold valid proxies, were denied entry due to safety concerns. So it certainly has been a contentious meeting for BP, and I think it just is underscored, as the questions have that have been heard inside the meeting, the tensions that surround this meeting and the questions that both investors and community members have.
You've recommended voting against or abstaining from BP accounts and reports. What does that mean exactly, and how many shareholders are with you on that?
Well, voting against the accounts and reports is, and as much of the BP ballot is really an opportunity to communicate with the BP board, particularly under UK law, where you have the opportunity to sort of register somewhat of a vote of confidence. And in particular, we chose to focus on the BP's account and reports, in part because one of our main concerns has been the lack of information, particularly meaningful information that's been available. And when we assessed their annual report, which came out several weeks ago, we really did find it lacking.
To what extent is your opposition here a result of BP's response to last year's Gulf oil spill?
Oh, it's certainly quite closely tied. When we did our assessment of the annual report, We really focused on four areas. One of them was safety and operational risk management, which clearly is centrally tied to what happened in the Gulf last year. We were also concerned about the remediation efforts there. In addition, we were wondering how the board is overseeing all of those issues and whether that has been strengthened adequately. And finally, BP has a whole trajectory on development projects in increasingly high-cost, high-risk areas like deepwater drilling, like the tar sands, highlights sort of a quandary that seems they seem to be having about their need to be involved in the transition to a low-carbon world. And we also are asking questions about where they stand in that regard.
Sir William Castell is the senior non-executive director who oversees BP's Safety, Ethics and Environment Assurance Committee. What's he done over the last year to improve BP's record after the spill? And did you vote for his reappointment?
No, we were recommending against his reappointment, in part because we'd been, you know, fairly dissatisfied with the progress of the company in that area. We were obviously joined by many. I believe the early preliminary results indicate that approximately 43% of shareholders voted either against or abstained from his reelection. And I think that while I'm sure few people know how to tie things directly to him, it certainly is, I think, a statement about people's concerns for that function of safety and risk management.
Can you just give a couple of examples of some concrete steps you'd like to see BP take to improve its environmental record?
When it comes to the environment, I think one of our strongest concerns is understanding how they are, the board in particular, is evaluating the risks and the costs that we see sort of exacerbated in a disaster like Deepwater Horizon. How that fits into their understanding of where their business is going, knowing that, and they have admitted this and set this as a goal themselves, to transition to a low-carbon economy. And that's something that I think still remains very unclear about how they both recognize the threat and the reality of climate change while continuing to pursue ever more costly and in many cases, more dangerous projects to pursue hydrocarbons.
Your stance here to try and make BP accountable in some way, ethically and environmentally, is admirable. But as we speak, deals going down that you've mentioned with the Russian oil company Rosneft involving drilling in the Arctic Circle. You've mentioned the tar sands extractions in Canada. Do you really think it's possible to invest in an oil company like you do and expect it to behave ethically?
I think it is possible for that to happen. I think it is a challenge, and I think, you know, sometimes for social investors in particular, there can be a great desire for our own comfort to withdraw from critical and challenging sectors of the economy, somehow hoping to keep our hands clean. But walking out the door and climbing in our car or climbing on the bus or getting on a plane, sort of ignoring the connection of the sort of the real world economy, even in our own lives. And we really believe that to have the type of long-lasting impact, we have to be engaged in the fullness of the economy. We're at a point where we're maybe not as happy as we have been in years past, but one that and a company that we think is worth investing time and energy in, and that I'm fairly certain we'll see significant improvements in the years ahead.
Mark Regier, Director of Stewardship Investing at MMA Praxis Mutual Funds. Thanks for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. This week, President Obama laid out his plan to cut the national deficit. His proposal sets the stage for what promises to be one of the biggest debates leading up to the 2012 elections. Matt Laszlo has the details from Washington.
House Republicans started this year's upcoming budget battle with their plan to overhaul Medicare and Medicaid. Many Democrats in Congress were hoping the president would use his bully pulpit for them. Their wish was answered Wednesday as President Obama countered the GOP. The president spoke out against Republicans' calls for a 70% cut from clean energy, a 25% reduction in education, and to trim 30% from transportation and infrastructure.
And worst of all, this is a vision that says even though Americans can't afford to invest in education at current levels or clean energy, even though we can't afford to maintain our commitment on Medicare and Medicaid, we can somehow afford more than $1 trillion in new tax breaks for the wealthy.
President Obama touted the expected $1 trillion in savings from the nation's new health care law and said the way to bolster Medicare and Medicaid is to find more savings in the programs, not deep cuts.
My approach would build on these reforms. We will reduce wasteful subsidies and erroneous payments. We will cut spending on prescription drugs by using Medicare's purchasing power to drive greater efficiency and speed generic brands of medicine onto the market. We will work with governors of both parties to demand more efficiency and accountability for Medicaid.
The president is also proposing his own cuts. He wants to trim $4 trillion from the nation's $14 trillion national debt. To get there, his administration wants its own cuts in non-defense spending, though he didn't lay out the specifics. Ethan Pollack, an analyst with the Economic Policy Institute, says Obama will likely try to defend social and job programs, but it's unclear which ones.
My concern is once you kind of start that process of looking at non-security discretionary budget with such large cuts, then you don't really know exactly where it's going to end.
Republicans have already shown they're adept at basically forcing cuts across the board. But one area their party has avoided cutting is defense spending. The president says that has to be on the table if the nation wants to trim its deficit.
We need to not only eliminate waste and improve efficiency and effectiveness, but we're going to have to conduct a fundamental review of America's missions, capabilities, and our role in a changing world. I intend to work with Secretary Gates and the Joint Chiefs on this review, and I will make specific decisions about spending after it's complete.
The Progressive Caucus says to truly cut the budget, the U.S. needs to end its wars. Democratic Congressperson Keith Ellison of Minnesota says any talk of deficit reduction needs to include a debate on ending involvement in foreign conflicts.
They're not bringing peace to America, and they're incredibly expensive, not only in dollars, but in the lives of our American soldiers and those of other people abroad.
Then there's tax policy. At the end of last year, the president accepted a compromise that extended tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. On Wednesday, President Obama said the GOP plan to raise health rates on seniors while maintaining tax cuts for the wealthy breaks the American social compact.
They want to give people like me a $200,000 tax cut that's paid for by asking 33 seniors each to pay $6,000 more in health costs.
Members of both major political parties agree the president used the address as more of a campaign speech than anything else. Democrats, like their caucus chair, John Larson, say it's good to see Obama go on the offensive. But Larson admits the president is moving more to the middle as a part of his national role.
Now, is that frustrating to Democrats? You betcha. But it's part of the process that we're dealing with here. And I have to give him credit because he remains consistent in his beliefs of how he has to function as president of the United States.
House Republicans vote Friday on their 2012 budget. The president says he wants negotiations between the parties to pick up in May. Both sides have said there are certain areas where they refuse to budge, which observers say means the debate over the nation's spending priorities is about to get really heated. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Also in Washington, the House passed the 2011 budget compromise, which includes $40 billion in cuts to the current year's budget. Lawmakers also attached a controversial rider that environmentalists say threatens the Endangered Species Act. The provision allows some western states, including Montana and Idaho, to remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list, and will be the first time Congress, rather than a science-based federal agency, has directly intervened to take an animal off the list. The rider is backed by Democrat Senator John Tester from Montana and Republican Representative Mike Simpson from Idaho. Their anti-wolf rider responds to concerns from ranchers about wolf attacks on their livestock and hunters who say elk and moose numbers are in decline because there are now too many wolves. According to defenders of wildlife, at the last official count, there were about 540 wolves in Montana and 705 in Idaho. The organization's Rocky Mountain Region Director, Mike Leahy, says the anti-Wolf rider will mean Montana and Idaho will only have to maintain 100 to 150 wolves per state, and Oregon, Washington, and Utah will not have to maintain any wolves in northern and eastern parts of their states.
There's a lot of anti-wolf sentiment in these states, particularly in the state legislatures and some of the governor's office, and they tend to call the shots on wildlife management. So there's a legitimate threat that the states will take advantage of that flexibility and start reducing wolves down to unsustainable numbers. What it means for the Endangered Species Act is now that anytime anybody has an issue or a problem with an endangered species, which is often, they will run to Congress and try to get the same sort of deal that the people opposed to wolf conservation are getting.
Leahy says there are about 360,000 elk and hundreds of thousands of deer in the three northern Rocky states, compared to about 1,650 wolves. He says there are already measures in place that allow wolf populations to be culled if they threaten livestock. The anti-wolf rider is one of numerous budget provisions that affect the environment. But others will come from slashed funding, including nearly $1 billion from clean water programs, about $150 million from the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and about $50 million from climate change programs. The bill also prohibits the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration from using funds to establish a climate service. The plight of more than 100,000 refugees from Myanmar, also known as Burma, is in question following statements from Thailand's Prime Minister that his government wants to shut down refugee camps along the border, some of which have been operating for decades. Some of the refugees are former political prisoners who spent years in Myanmar prisons and were subject to torture and forced labour. From the Thai-Burma border, Gayatri Lakshmi Bai and Felix Saeed report.
On August 8, 1988, university students started demonstrations against Myanmar's repressive regime. They quickly spread throughout the country and lasted over a month. But a bloody crackdown put an end to the popular 8888 uprising, killing thousands of people. Many of those who survived were thrown in prison, including Tihai Azhar. He spent 18 years in several prisons and says the price he and his colleagues paid for demanding democracy is unimaginable.
At the interrogation centers, I was put in the dark room for 2 days. Finally, I was, my hands were handcuffs behind me, and then I was on a chair. They covered my head with a hood, and then they beat me. They punched me on my face and they kicked me, and then I fell down with the chair. And then they kicked me in my ribs. And when I was thirsty, I asked for water from them. They took me to the toilet. Filthy, dirty. So they gave the toilet water.
Yarzar says that this was kind torture. It only got worse as days, weeks, months, and years passed by. He has many scars to remind him of his time as a prisoner.
In a rubber tube, they fill up with sand and they beat me with it. They beat me and my hands broken, my head lots of scars here. Then they hit me with pistol. And then they pour water on my face. At the time, I was like a cradle between two poles. My hands and my ankle. Yeah, two people side by side, they kick me like this. I was, swinging. And at the same time, they pour water on my face.
According to Human Rights Watch, political prisoners are held in 43 prisons and 50 camps, where they are forced into labor. In March, the government released 8 political prisoners, but more than 2,000 remain in detention. Once released, political prisoners find it difficult to reside inside Myanmar owing to prolonged threats from the military. Most flee the country to Thailand. There, many live without documentation in refugee camps or around the border area, where they battle years of bureaucracy seeking legal refugee status or resettlement in a third country. Being resettled in a first world country often doesn't put an end to all problems. Dr. Kunsai is one such case. He has been resettled in the UK for the past 3 years. However, British authorities have refused to allow his wife and 3-year-old son to accompany him. His family continues to live in Umphiam refugee camp along the Thai-Myanmar border. We met Dr. Kunsai at the refugee camp when he was paying a visit to his family.
My resettlement in UK is practically it's a family separation. The only meaning is family separation. I've been resettled in UK for 3 years and 5 months, and since then I was separated. This is my second visit, and first visit is last year January. At the time I first met my son for the first time. At the time my son was 2 years and 3 months old.
This refugee camp is home to about 15,000 refugees from Myanmar. There is a UN refugee office here, but it was closed when we visited. And camp residents say that they hardly ever see the office open. Thailand is one of the few countries that hasn't signed the UN's Refugee Convention. And if caught by Thai officials, former political prisoners end up paying hefty bribes or risk being sent back into Myanmar. The only support they receive is from small NGOs working on the border, like the one German national Markus Bauder set up in Mesot with ex-political prisoners.
The aim was, first of all, to assist ex-political prisoners living here in any terms, whatever they need. And my special interest, because I was always interested in psychology, was to help them, you know, overcome torture, trauma. So we figured out this is a big problem for many of them living here. And the next thing is that since many of them never finished their university or their education, we want to offer some training.
Bauder's NGO, Expact, hopes to help around 120 political prisoners living in Mesot. But recent statements made by the Thai government have put into question the fate of an estimated 140,000 refugees. Government officials say they are in the process of negotiating the return of refugees with Myanmar officials. Refugees and their advocates have denounced the move, saying it amounts to forced repatriation. With Felix Saeed, I'm Gayatri Lakshmi Bai, FSRN, on the Thai-Myanmar border.
The European Union is hoping that the swearing-in of a new Burmese government last month with some civilian members could be a signal that the human rights situation there may improve. Yesterday, in recognition of this change, the EU lifted its visa ban and asset freeze on some civilian members of Burma's government. Human rights advocates say the new government is a sham because it's dominated by military appointees. And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.